Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our conversation continues with Alec Ross, Senior Advisor for Innovation at the U.S. Department of State. Also joining us from IBM is Bonnie Glick. Alec, we hear a lot about so-called push technology, where information is pushed out in forms of text, messages, alerts. What about going beyond this push technology and using social media to create actual exchanges? How important is it for you to create a virtual connection with people?
Well, I think that's where some of the better opportunities come. So push technology can be a good thing. For example, there are these things called the white spaces, which are the unused spaces in text messages. And in South Africa, there's been a program to put information into those quote-unquote white spaces about HIV prevention. And it's had a dramatic impact in terms of people availing themselves of services. What would be good, though, and going to your question, is the next level of innovation. And this is something we're looking at, which is in addition to just getting people to read it, if what you're able to then do is create a relationship with a healthcare provider based on people who get that text message, who are interested, who do want to engage. Now, this is also a clear case, though, where even in the United States, even in very high-income Western countries, the innovations that are taking place are largely taking place now. So it's not like we are yet, you know, way out ahead of the rest of the world. What I think the great opportunity is as things prove to work, let's quickly bring them to the developing world.
Great. And that brings us, too, to this concept of what the embassy of the future is going to look like. And the State Department's concept of the embassy of the future argues that buildings themselves will play less of a role in furthering America's diplomatic goals in the future, while outreach and access will grow increasingly important. If that's the case, it calls for some serious rethinking of how and what to build. In your perspective, what will embassies look like in the future, and what role will technology play in building them? To what extent are you looking at virtual technologies like, for example, Second Life in this effort?
Yeah, I think that physical embassies remain very important. You know, while I'm very excited and enthusiastic about most things technological, I do think that there's a real value and virtue to the physical presence of the U.S. embassies. Now, that said, particularly in countries like China, with just so many people and so many people who are trying to reach, and we can't build consulates all over a country as vast as China, what an embassy then can be is sort of an informational hub. It can almost become like a strategic center for how we do engagement. You have to be in country to know what the local dynamics are. And an embassy then can be, again, sort of the strategic center for what is done. As for virtual worlds like Second Life and things that are exclusively virtual, I'm just going to be just totally blunt and say I'm a little bit of a skeptic about that. I'm sorry. I know that a lot of people are excited by it, and I know that people have done some interesting things there, you know, in trying to promote their business and what have you. And maybe in 5 or 10 years, there'll be something there that I think is worthy of the State Department's investment and for us to build sort of virtual posts there. And I know we do a little bit of work there now, but I'm just personally very skeptical right now. I think that, you know, virtual worlds have not evolved to the point yet where I think it merits the attention of Hillary Clinton and of our senior diplomatic officials.
Technology is a crucial leveler, but the challenge is ultimately one of governance and management. To what extent is the virtual network an opportunity for government leaders who are asked to do more with less each day, the best way to serve citizens?
You know, I think that a great example of this, if I'm allowed to point to the campaign, came from the campaign, which was, you know, in the early days of 2007 when then-Senator Obama decided that he wanted to run for president. he had to figure out how to do more with less, because he knew he wasn't – he thought he wasn't going to raise the most money. He certainly didn't have the most relationships around the countries or the physical infrastructure that other candidates had. And so what he said is, you know, let's use technology as a great leveler. Let's use it as a way of connecting to people where we're never going to build field offices. And that then became a great proof point for what I think is possible in government, where, again, if government officials are comfortable enough to give up a measure of control, and what we do is we make information available to people, it then can be mashed up and organized by third parties, by citizens in ways that produce a public good. A real leader in this right now is the White House CIO, a guy named Vivek Kundra. And he came to that job previously having been the chief technology officer for the District of Columbia. And he took a very revolutionary approach to government data, which was to say, let's take data that is not security sensitive and let's stream it. Let's stream it in real time on our websites so that anybody can learn what pollutant levels are in, you know, any segment of a city. Let's, you know, make all of the on-time arrivals and the progress of bus schedules and metros, let's all put it out there in its rawest form. Now, in its rawest form, putting data, putting government information on the internet is not necessarily that useful to people. But when you give up control, what happens is you can then spur innovation by people who will develop applications. So now you can get an iPhone application so that you know exactly when the next metro is coming. So when you're walking down the street, you can know, you know, to the minute whether you should go down the tunnel and grab the metro or stay on the street and grab a bus. More significantly, with EPA data, you know, I've got three little kids. I've got a 2-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 7-year-old. And if my wife and I wanted to buy a home and we were moving into a community, we could literally look at different homes and check them out based on the pollutant levels of, you know, the streams running through the backyards. Government has all of this information. And so one of the ways in which we can use technology to empower people is to actually give the American citizens access to that information and then allow people to mash it up and build applications that are constituent friendly.
And how does it facilitate transparency and accountability?
This is all about transparency and accountability. So it's really about going from information being something that's coveted, that's hidden away, that's locked in a closet that only a handful of experts are allowed to look at and ponder, and to recognize the wisdom of the American people and to trust the American people with information so that they know what to do with it. And it's a way of actually making government less paternalistic. You know, I think that a lot of, especially as developing technology applications becomes easier, as technology becomes less expensive and more sophisticated, is if you just put the information out there, people will use it for their own good. But the big change is a mind shift away from information being something that's hidden, that's secret, that we assume is not useful to people, to making it available.
Well, and when it comes to government agencies that are adapting to this networked age, the State Department is really leading the way. Can you tell us more about State Department's internal use of social media technologies such as Diplopedia or DipNote?
Sure. So Diplopedia is based on, you know, people may be familiar with the Wikipedia model. So Wikipedia, for example, takes a topic, somebody's name, and then anybody is able to come in as an editor and add and adjust it to, you know, the point where it's most accurate. One of the challenges in the Foreign Service is that people move very often. And one of the things that, you know, if you've lived in Beijing for the last 3 years, you might have acquired over those 3 years some really good information. But the problem is that if you are then leaving, how is what you've learned captured? And in an organization like the State Department with tens of thousands of people, it's not enough to just say, oh, I'm going to talk to my successor, or oh, I'm going to write a memo where I write all of this down. So Diplopedia is something that's available for State Department employees where people are basically able to share information on topics about which they are expert so that what they learned when they're posted abroad lives on after they leave. DipNote is a blog. So DipNote is, you know, it's the comings and goings of the secretary. It lets people know what big announcements are. So this is an evolution, you know, past what I would say is sort of the conventional press room. So the press room lives on, its importance lives on. But what we want to be able to do is stream information to people in real time as it's occurring. And DipNote is a way of doing that. And one of the ways that people are accessing it increasingly is not just at www.state.gov, but also now through Twitter. So there are a large number of people who are now accessing this Twitter and getting these feeds, you know, throughout the day from the State Department.
So neat. We talked to a lot of our guests about collaboration. What kinds of interagency, private sector, and nonprofit partnerships are you developing to improve operations or outcomes at State? And what are you doing to enable the success of these partnerships?
So, you know, as was the case with the example from Mexico that I gave, I think most of the partnerships that I'm personally focused on are public-private. They tend to involve the private sector. They tend to involve big companies, government, and nonprofit organizations. Another example that I would give is the Democratic Republic of Congo. I recently got back from the Congo, and the Congo is the least banked place on Earth. So far, far, far less than 1% of the population have a banking account. It is entirely a cash-in-the-mattress economy. And that produces a lot of problems, from creating conditions that are more prone to corruption to things like it being physically near impossible to pay soldiers. So the capital of Congo is in Kinshasa, which is far, 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 far away from East Congo, particularly given how lousy the transportation lines are. And so an example of a partnership that we're developing there is to bring mobile banking into the country. Even though there isn't great transportation infrastructure, there is great mobile telecommunications infrastructure. I remember getting off the UN plane in Goma, where there's a per capita GDP of $184. That means there's $184 per person per year. So it's incredibly poor. But there are as many 3G wireless networks in Goma as there are in Washington, D.C. And there are hundreds and hundreds of cell phone kiosks. And just about everybody uses cell phones there. So the cell phone then can be this great distribution channel for doing what we call mobile banking. Which is an innovation that was actually born out of Kenya, which we then brought to Afghanistan. And so as we see best practices, even if they're not American best practices, in this case it was a Kenyan best practice, our role is to connect and convene and build partnerships that have a public good, such as mobile banking in Congo.
It's wonderful. Are you looking to expand any more of the public-private partnerships you're involved in with the State Department?
Absolutely. And this is something that is very characteristic of Secretary Clinton. So going back, frankly, decades, I mean, going back to the time when she was First Lady of the State of Arkansas, this was always a technique that she used to great effect. I mean, Hillary Clinton has always understood that if you can bring together public and private actors to solve a problem, it's going to be more effective than a just government solution or a just private solution. And so she has built an office at the State Department specifically focused on the development of public-private efforts. It's a big focus of mine. And, you know, the challenge for me now is not to develop these as one-offs, but to develop models that are scalable globally. So if we build a model for bringing mobile banking to Afghanistan, which we did, and if we're then trying to apply that model in Congo, the question then becomes, okay, if this is a good thing, if this is helping millions of people and saving tens and hundreds of millions of dollars, how can it then be scaled to 6, 12, 20 countries?
Alec, we talked a lot about this technology, the mobility of it, the democratization of access to the network and communication. And yet, as I think about it, diplomacy is about stability. It's about forging relationships, state actors typically. How do you manage both? How do you balance the fact that the trend is towards openness and access with the need to keep things a little bit more stable?
Yeah. So first of all, the disruption that takes place because of technology, because of democratized access to information, I got news for you. It's taken place with or without us. There is nothing, nobody in Washington can walk down a marble hallway and say, I want this to stop. I got news for you. This is a bigger dynamic than anything any of us can control. And it's only going to get bigger and more pronounced. So the challenge then is, what are you going to do about it? The 21st century is a lousy time to be a control freak. You know, all of those things that we tried to do as a matter of command and control that we could do as a matter of command and control during the Cold War, good luck doing it now. You're just going to get rolled by the dynamics that are created by an increasingly networked society. So if you understand that, if you say that's neither good nor bad, it is what it is, what are we going to do about it, then you engage and you try to maximize the degree to which it can create stability. But the thing that you can't do is ignore it, click your heels together and say there's no time like 50 years ago. It just doesn't work.
What does the future hold for the U.S. Department of State? We will ask Alec Ross, Senior Advisor for Innovation at the U.S. Department of State, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.